This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts address the housing crisis in Utah and what can be done to improve affordability, access, and equity for Utah's growing population. Information from the 2020 census shows Utah was the fastest growing state over the last decade, with a population increase of 18.4%. Utah now has nearly 3.28 million people, making it the 30th most populous state. However, this first-in-the-nation growth was actually smaller than the increase from 2000 to 2010, when Utah's population grew by 23.8%. Due to this rapidly growing population and lack of pre-existing infrastructure, Utah has been caught in a severe housing shortage and currently lacks about 40,000 affordable units. To address these long-standing issues in Utah and their impacts on local communities, Governor Spencer Cox signed several bills to promote more affordable housing projects and increase state investments in homelessness initiatives. In total, the 2021 Utah legislature invested $50 million to address the housing crisis. Today's panel of experts will discuss how Utah's growth affects its housing market, the impact of the pandemic and federal relief funds, and how we can create a more equitable outcome for all Utahns. The panelists include Evis Garcia Zambrana, assistant professor in the City and Metropolitan Planning Department at the University of Utah, Beth Marshall, 211 Managing Director of United Way of Salt Lake, Michael Parker, Ivory Homes Vice President of Public Affairs, Marketing, and Senior Economist, and Jim Wood, Ivory Boyer Senior Fellow at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. Moderating today's discussion is Dayan Eskich, Senior Research Fellow at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. This forum was put on in partnership with the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute and the David Eccles School of Business, Daniels Fund Ethics Initiative. This forum was recorded on March 16, 2021. Here is your moderator, Dayan Eskich.
Before we begin with everybody, I wanted to ask Jim Wood, how did we get here? What's been the housing challenge leading up to the pandemic? And then we'll open it up to the rest of the panel to talk about what they're seeing from their corner of the world in terms of housing and what they're dealing with. Jim?
Well, thanks, Dayan. Pleasure to be with you and to talk about the housing crisis. We have really been in a housing crisis pre-COVID for probably 5 years or six since the Great Recession. We've had really accelerating prices for housing, which really have excluding a lot of people from the housing market. The rental market has had 9 years well, 8 years pre-COVID with the vacancy rate below 4%. Rental rates have been going up at 5 to 7%. And homeownership housing prices have increased in the last 5 years in Salt Lake County by almost 60%. So it's been a period of really declining affordability for both homeowners and renters. At the same time, we've had very rapid rates of demographic and economic growth that are putting pressure on the market. So leading up to COVID, it was a happy story for those who were in the housing market, those homeowners, but for others trying to get in and for renters, it was a really difficult market with declining affordability.
And then how has COVID, and we'll move throughout the panel, how has COVID exacerbated a problem? What has COVID done to the housing market that's made it a bigger challenge than it already does, or it has been?
I'm happy to answer that question. Beth Marshall with Utah 211, which is a statewide health and human services information and referral. So anyone in the state of Utah can connect with us while they have basic needs and really try to identify how they can get those needs met from health or, again, human services. So I see and describe ourselves as being like that social barometer of needs. James made a great point. Already we can see within our data years before the pandemic, people in Utah were absolutely struggling around not only housing, because it's not in a vacuum, but primarily that it is the first and foremost reason why people have been connecting with us, but then also with utilities and then with food and meals and so on and so forth. But with COVID and the pandemic that we are in, we've seen a couple of things that have occurred. The moratorium, and then also an increase of services. And so from a two-on-one perspective, it's been pretty remarkable to see a 35% increase from 2019 to 2020, where people are asking, even with the moratorium that is really preventing economic and health harm, for support around primarily rent payment assistance, being able to seek low-income and subsidized rental housing, and then really being on the fringes, if not already moving into the network of the homeless shelters, if they are, you know, going in that route, if it's not being with family and friends, and how can they sometimes are with the restrictions of COVID, we can't be in the same space of where maybe where options were before. I certainly have more to add to that, but the last point that I will say is that what we're seeing exponentially is a disparities within the evictions that are happening within those who are renting. We're seeing BIPOC or racial disparities within those rates. We're seeing a lot of these nuances that are coming from unmet housing needs within Davis, Salt Lake, Utah, and Weber counties. But that doesn't exclude our rural communities throughout the state of Utah as well.
Interesting. So, Evis, I was going to come over to you and have you share kind of your perspective on it.
Yes, and I wanted to share like an anecdote, and it's like from myself, actually. So I bought a house, and this was like in 2016 for $250, and I barely qualified for that home. And that's like as an assistant professor here at the University of Utah in the West Side in Rose Park. And then I sold that home because there was a crisis in my family and because of like hurricanes Maria. So I needed to help my family. And I sold the home and then I left for Puerto Rico for 1 year. When I came back, I tried to buy again in the West Side, and that was like impossible at that time. So I the home that I bought for $250 in 2 years, I actually like got an equity of like $60,000. Right now that home is like $160,000 more. So it's like a huge amount compared to 2016. And people are looking west, and that is really affecting the Rose Park community and also just like the whole West Side, where we know that it's like 50% Latino. So a lot of people are buying cash. I actually got a cash offer, and sadly, I actually like accepted this because it is a matter of like at the end of the day, even if people send you love letters, which is what people are doing, they're sending love letters to saying like, I lived in this neighborhood and now when I grew up and now I cannot afford to live here, but you're going to go with the highest price that you can get as a homeowner. Also like obviously to help yourself and your family. So, and also like people are offering cash, right? As you say, Dejan, so showing that picture of like we buy homes as cash. So those are the people who are winning right now in the market. And that it will have like huge consequences for the Latino community, obviously, that are moving more and more and more west because people are looking into buy condos, which is what I did, or just moving west. So we will see like definitely a shift, just like moving even like into the future. And with COVID, what is happening is also the Latino community is being more impacted because they are like working more in the service sector. And we know that those are the jobs that are like mostly affected.
Thank you, Ives. Michael, I want to ask you from a private point of view and a home builder's perspective, what has the COVID year looked like for the industry, and what are those challenges that you have dealt with and continue to deal with?
Well, thank you, Dayan. And I think the picture you shared is, it does capture the moment that we have a vibrant new construction, all-time permits. We also have, you know, tents on the streets, and we have dynamics in the market that Ives spoke to that simply are pricing out the average Utahn in a real way, especially those in vulnerable situations that Beth sees through the 211 service. And thankfully, I think, you know, over this past year, there's been a strong sentiment of strong rental assistance, which has put a cushion underneath what could have been a very dangerous situation. But from our perspective, first and foremost, I think in March and April, we weren't sure if the market was gonna just completely dry up and, you know, fall out with the rest of the economy. And so in many regards, the summer months were a surprise in terms of just the dynamics in the market. I think few people would have expected what has happened in the existing market around the inventory really dropping there. But as Jim's been talking about for several years, we've known there's a massive shortage in the market. I think our low income neighbors have been feeling that for 5 years plus. And now the first time home buyer and the average Utahn is starting to see the consequences of an overwhelming shortage that we just can't catch up to at this point. And so we're starting to see that creep into more moderate and middle income families simply being priced out of a first time home. For us, a couple dynamics that are important for us to touch on. One is this demand piece. It's been, you know, Utah has continued to grow through COVID. In many respects, all of our strengths have been accentuated. Our quality of life is attracting people, our economy, we've managed and balanced COVID fairly well relative to other states. So we're primed to kind of leap out of this recession bigger than other states. That's going to put more demand on housing. We're seeing buyers come from out of state with cash on hand, with the equity that they're walking from, for example, California. Anecdote from our company is over the past 2 years, about 20% of our buyers have been from out of state, but still leaves 80% that are our friends, family, kids, grandkids. So it's still majority Utahns, but there's certainly immigration that's taking place. The other thing that was a big surprise this year and has only gotten worse in 2021 is our costs. Just last year, lumber went up by $24,000 per home. So lumber is the key material into most of your homes, going up at such a rate. We're feeling the pressures of drywall, sheathing. You know, you hear about ships stuck at ports in LA. That's your washer and dryer. That's your appliances. Like, we're seeing knock-on effects to a lot of the supply chain disruptions, both on pricing and availability. You know, and Jim's point around pricing in general, you know, we're getting into a market dynamic that I think is really unhealthy. In that 5 year span, we've seen prices go up 60%, and incomes have not kept pace with that, nor that should they. We shouldn't see incomes rise 60% in 5 years. And so we've really got to focus on this side of the coin and figure out some different solutions that we can bring to the table.
Thank you, Michael. It's staggering to think about housing affordability and affordable housing and the elements of the costs of going into the home, and how do you deliver a more affordable product is really a challenging question. I want to segue a little bit more into this question of, you know, we've seen a lot of government assistance this year as a result of COVID, and, you know, each legislative session there is some sort of initiative, or, you know, we gain a little steam on the housing issue. But to open it up, what is the role of the state or federal government in helping out on the issue? And is this a personal issue or is it a society issue? And how do we balance that out with government programs and letting the individual market do its thing? So, Jim, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this. Kind of open us up with what your thoughts are on that.
Well, traditionally, the role has been played by the federal government. Most of the assistance programs, almost all of the assistance programs that really help affordable housing and those most in need are federal programs. Oftentimes they're passed through to state government offices. So they've played a huge role. And the state in the last 3 years, induced because of the homeless situation we had in Salt Lake City, the legislature got involved. And I know Michael's worked a little bit on that, so I'll let him cover the state. But as I said, the feds have been the main player. The state has taken a kind of a back role and turned some issues over to the locals. That is the issue of land use. Of course, we have no control over labor, materials, and land costs. But through voucher programs, through a number of programs that HUD has, particularly the tax credit program that it's administered locally, but the money is, the program is set up by the feds and the treasury. And we have about 30,000 units in Utah that have some sort of rental assistance from the tax credit program. That's the major program. We got 300,000 renters, let's put that in context. So about 1 in 10 renters are living in a tax credit project. And then we got about 18,000 vouchers, and that's the other main program. So those two programs comes up close to 50,000. We're talking closing in on 20% of renters, but it's way short of what we need for affordable housing. And just a comment on COVID and housing and a comparison to what we saw in the Great Recession. In the Great Recession, we had $800 billion total in federal assistance, and it went to primarily banks, bail out the banks. Homeowners, renters got zero. This time, and I think a lot of it has to do with the political environment at the time when COVID hit, and we were in an election year. And so politicians always like to increase expenditures and funds during election year. It looks good for the campaign in November. But we got just huge amounts of assistance from the federal government. And some of it's policy and some of it is a large part is funds. For example, Utah has received from the federal government and rental assistance since COVID began. First from the CARES Act, we got $20 million for rental assistance, which didn't go very far, but it was all used. And once landlords learned of that and they interacted with their tenants that were hard pressed and having trouble making rent, then the program stepped up and really accelerated. In the December round of the fiscal stimulus, the state got another $215 million for rental assistance, 10 times what we got in the CARES Act in March. And the $1.9 trillion just passed and signed, we're going to get another 200 plus million. So we're going to have over $400 million in rental assistance come to the state. That's a lot of money, really a lot of money, and it will cushion. Now, I think we can spend this. They're not going to release all the money at once. There's some hoops that cities and counties have to jump through, but it will allow for renters to pay back rent as well as future rent. So it's most of these programs address households who are at 80% or less of area median income. So Salt Lake County, for a family of four, you're talking about, oh, $55,000 or so. But they're targeting really those who are suffering from housing cost burden in the assistance. So very different than what happened in the Great Recession. COVID indirectly has impacted housing prices, has impacted driving them up because of low interest rates. And it's caused, as I said earlier, declining affordability, I think. But we have a really, and that photograph you led with is a beautiful example of the inequality. On one hand, you've got the homeless, the unsheltered homeless, and then you've got new construction and a reference, of course, to the housing market and that booming market. But anyway, it's COVID has had almost a reverse effect on housing, on the housing market in terms of new construction, but we're still way short. And it's not those, as always, those with higher incomes are doing better, and our affordable housing is still a crisis. We just don't have enough. And the main cause of that homelessness is we don't have enough housing. It's an interesting case study, COVID and housing.
That was Jim Wood, Ivory Boyer Senior Fellow at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel of experts discuss the housing crisis in Utah and how we build a system that is accessible and affordable for all. Here again is your moderator, Dayan Eskich, Senior Research Fellow at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute.
So I'll move it over to Beth. You know, given the program you run and given this federal stimulus and headway we're making locally, tell us more about the importance of having that safety net and how you're anticipating this money will be used in the coming months.
Absolutely. So I think that while the work of nonprofit, our work, our service is being very complementary to the federal stimulus, but it's not without a public and private partnerships that are at the table too, and government that's available to be able to move forward with these endeavors. 2-1-1 team has been really thoughtful about how do we connect people to the resources to see them thrive. We all want Utahns to thrive. And when we see and hear messages or interactions coming through to us about people who are needing that rent payment assistance because their jobs have been in jeopardy, because they've missed work, they've been fired, because they've had COVID, they might not have an authentic rent application and they're in a compromising situation of renting someone's RV, their living room, their garage, and people are okay with maneuvering in those spaces. I have to think about it's great to have these resources. The state just opened up a rent relief portal. There's a great application process that's available to renters and to homeowners that are renting those spaces. But when I'm interacting with people who are needing these particular services, one thing that's not crossing their minds is it's not necessarily a housing situation. It is also a legal situation, especially if they're being evicted. And they're not necessarily thinking about it in that respect, right? Crisis is happening. There's a lot of things on their minds. And what happens if they have children as well? So what jeopardy are the children being placed in? What is that lack of digital connection in addition to just a roof over their head, and how's that impacting their education and their overall basic needs of health and stability? So while I'm thinking about, there's a great resource and all parties are at the table to really try to advance and do what we do well. We have industry in the state of Utah and we have great collaboration. And through that, I really feel like these, you know, stimulus and deferral programs are designed in a way that isn't intended to cause harm. But there are certainly people who are in the fabric of our communities that are absolutely essential and important that are not going to always, in the past, be able to receive this support. Now, this rent payment assistance that Jim had referred to, not only does it help with back payments and future payments with utilities, but also digital connections and whatnot. And so for me, it's a question of how do we advocate for a system change? I think that we need to be in contact with not only our representatives at a higher level, but even our city council members and thinking about our ordinances. We have mother-in-law apartments that might not be able to be rented that can help alleviate perhaps a homeless situation in crisis. We have other businesses that are looking to purchase hotels and motels and help lessen the burden of the homelessness crisis that we have, not only in Salt Lake County, but in our state. I hope that answers your question, and I wasn't a politician and deviating from that specific question.
No, that was a great response. Speaking on that, on the preservation side, Michael, I'm going to turn it over to you and ask you just how important is the role with public-private partnerships, and tell us a little bit about this preservation initiative and why is it important and why do we even have to have it?
I think it's great. Thanks, Dion. And I think, you know, Jim's research on this, to Beth's point, there's 53,000 Utahns living on the quote edge. They're one event away from being homeless. We can't simply build an emergency room big enough for something like that. That's a waste of resources. It's not smart. It's not ethical to stand at what we're talking about today. So number one, we should be thankful and applaud the level of federal support around rental assistance. That is, to Jim's point, a substantial difference from the last crisis to this one. And I think something that's already proven effective and will remain effective both for the tenants and the landlords to shore up that part of the economy to keep it from totally falling apart, number one. Number two, I think you have to, before we just jump straight into preservation, I think a state lens has to be put on. And I think this session was a terrific session for beginning to make some real inroads on this issue related, especially at the lower end of the market and even at the middle market. And so the legislature is clearly indicating that they're in the game on addressing housing affordability is how I would put it. That starts with the $50 million they've set aside to partner with public and private partnerships around preservation, around new construction, around homelessness. But it goes beyond that to a mother-in-law bill statewide. That's a big step for our state. It's internal ADUs. It's not gonna solve the whole thing, but it does open up another avenue for supply. And frankly, it's just good public policy because it's gonna bring a lot of units that are informally rented now into the light of day. And that's better for the tenants and it's better for the landlord. So like, it may not be the panacea for supply, but it's good public policy. So that was a good step from Representative Ray Ward, and he fought hard for that. I loved seeing a doctor from Bountiful run an ADU bill. That told me that the dynamic at the legislature is really changing, that it's not somebody in our space running a bill like that. And the last piece I would just say is that partnership piece with the cities. Lots of cities are making an effort on this. I think sometimes mayors and cities become a scapegoat. I don't think that's a tone we should have in our community. I think we need to have a tone of we're all in on solutions. We're all in for wanting our kids and grandkids to have a safe place. We're all in that we see that picture at the beginning of this and find it unacceptable that that's Utah. I think we can all get to that place and then we can start unpacking solutions. But there is a potential and an existing dynamic of finger pointing that I don't think is helpful and doesn't move the ball. But to your last piece, kind of this bridge piece of public-private partnerships, the legislature did set aside $50 million for homelessness and housing. $10 million is going to new construction of affordable housing. That will lead to about 1,000 units, 1,500 new units. We need more. More is better. But if we don't stop the leaky bucket of existing affordable housing, and just in the next 5 years, we have about 2,500 units that will roll off the tax credit program. Those are highly advantageous market investments for some out-of-state funds to come in, get into those existing tax credit properties. And then when they roll off, jack the rents two or three times, put new countertops, put new paint, and kick out all the residents that were in there. So preservation has to be a core focus for our housing strategy right now. And I would just applaud again the legislature for stepping up with $25 million of seed equity that's going to get matched with equal amount of private donations and charitable contributions, $50 million roughly of social impact financing. So think foundations, Intermountain Healthcare is a key partner on this with us with their social determinants of health. So a whole new lens of who's a player in housing, that's a big deal there. And then community banks stepping up and saying, hey, we need to bring a competitive, right? They are for-profit institutions, but a competitive but philanthropic rate to a community cause to make sure we can leverage those initial dollars. So we think we can take that $25 million from the legislature, $25 million from the philanthropic community, and then the additional leverage I've described, and produce about, or save, I should say, about 3,000 units in the next few years, which if we can sync that up with the tax credit properties is gonna do a whole heck of a lot of good to put a net underneath that. So any new construction is actually additive to our supply and then we have somewhere to go. The last point I just really wanna make on the homeless piece is the $15 million they put towards that as part of this package is going to go into a whole new comprehensive budget process around homelessness, which I think is incredible. Because right now we have, as the governor would say, 14 steering wheels on that issue on homelessness. That's one piece of the puzzle, governance. Two is we're spending about $100 million a year on homelessness as a state. That's including pretty much all sources. So we're putting a lot of money into a very acute problem. And again, it's expensive to go to the emergency room for healthcare, right? If you just need a health check, for you to go to the emergency room is not the smartest decision you can make. But that's what we're forcing on this issue around homelessness. We're not very good at the prevention piece. We're not very good at taking people and getting them to Beth on 2-on-1 and getting them out of the resource centers because the statistics on that are just terrible. You have a 1 in 3 chance pretty much returning to shelter within 30 to 90 days if you end up there. And so another piece of this has to be focused on keeping people in their homes with the rental assistance. And when we find somebody that becomes housing unstable, not getting them to the front door of the shelter. That's a bad dynamic to build into our system. We need to find alternative ways to help source them and get them into units that we're adding to the market right now. So there's a lot of great things going on. I think our community is really rallying around this problem. It's a complex one. Homelessness itself is beyond complex. Every individual in that situation, that picture you showed at the beginning, if you were to go knock on each tent, each one of those people probably has a different reason for how they got to where they are and probably myriads of reasons why they got to where they are. So unpacking that, creating systemic change on something like that is very difficult, but I would say we're headed in the right direction. And as we feed up to the market, I think there's a healthy link being made between what's happening on the street and a first-time home buyer not being able to get into a home at the same time. I think those two narratives are merging, and they're good that they're merging.
Great. And as researching this issue, I'm so excited that we have this program. I go back and forth with Jim, and you know, he tells me about stories from the 80s that they tried something and, you know, it didn't work. So the fact that we got the ball rolling on this is pretty remarkable. Ivis, I want to ask you, as you know, being from the city and metropolitan planning department, you deal with local zoning and issues with that. What can cities do at a local level and community leaders at a local level to, you know, take this momentum we're making with some of our housing program and the funds we've have as a result of all this stimulus? What can we do on a local level to incentivize cities and help deal with NIMBYism to make sure that we're treating that aspect of equity, quality, and diversity with you know, sincerity?
So I think that in terms of like zoning, the city is like concentrating in trying to build more density around the transit station areas specifically. And I think that in a way could reduce potentially the part of like what you need to spend, right, between housing and transportation. At the same time, I think that a lot of the concentration have been in creating market rate housing, and with like some housing could have affordability, but I think that the city could do like better in terms of like incentivizing more affordable housing in order to have a balance. And there's some policies that the city is doing, trying to incentivize like mixed income, because we know that that creates also more opportunities for people as opposed to be like low income individuals segregated in one place. But I think that one of the things that I have seen is like the loans that are given, sometimes they don't ensure that affordability goes beyond a particular point. So thinking about you know, the reselling of buildings to make sure that you ensure that there's affordability, because what I have seen is that there's a building that is built, and then like a few years later it's put for sale, or it's like actually permanently for sale, which is kind of an interesting dynamic. I don't know like how pervasive that is. But through that, the RDA, for example, they could look into just like in the loans they give, saying, okay, so there's this many years and it should be maintained affordable. I think that ADUs are also a great way to add some affordability, but at the same time, ADUs are expensive, right, to build. So like loans are needed for more moderate income families to be able to access that, and also like technical assistance. And I know that the city has like done some of that as well, but it's like a little bit limited. Also like in thinking about the permits that are given, so you need like more of like conditional uses if you're in certain parts of the city. And it seems to me that a lot of those parts in the city are in the west side or in central city, in places that are that might be like lower income. So I think that making those things more similar, like, you know, it's okay to have to jump less hoops, like if you or it should not be okay, I should say, jump less hoops if you're in the avenues than if you live in the west side. And obviously providing technical assistance as well for people to be able to do that. And I think that, again, in general, more affordable housing and landlords that are more willing to accept people that might also have multiple evictions, because like I have done some work looking at the rapid rehousing program, which was like, it had a lot of vouchers at the, after the recession, and then it kind of have less vouchers. So there is a challenge because there's a lot of families that are experiencing homelessness right now, and they have been experiencing homelessness for a while, and they're not getting that assistance. So hopefully kind of like maintaining that, as opposed to when the recession happened, that you have less vouchers available for people that you needed it, that needed them. That would be something that it'll be important, because what ends up happening is only the most vulnerable families are able to access those vouchers, and a lot of them are going to end up coming back to the shelter. Especially like when looking at leases, looking at programs that do have like master leasing, it could be good, because what happens is that you don't know for how long your voucher is going to be, right? So you get a voucher for 3 months, but you have to sign a lease for a year. And that's problematic as well, because you can end up getting an eviction in your record, because there was no certainty of like for how long you were getting that voucher. And there's obviously issues with master leasing as well. But if we get like landlords that might be willing, or entities that like the row home, for instance, they do have master leasing. So entities that will be able to do that, I think that will give like more opportunities for the family that is like placed there, without having to face a future eviction.
That was Evis Garcia Zambrana, assistant professor in the City and Metropolitan Planning Department at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel answers questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here's your moderator, Dayan Eskich, Senior Research Fellow at the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute.
We have a first question. What are practical solutions to housing affordability as gentrification is taking over, especially in the West Side? And I think, Evis, you kind of touched on that. Do you have more to add there, or others, on that topic of gentrification and affordability?
I mean, that is like a tough one, right? Because like, I mean, the idea with like the homeowners is that eventually they could face also like higher taxes, right? So there's like programs that in other cities they have, in where you grandfather the taxes and people pay less. So that's something that we can look into the future. I don't think as of right now the taxes are higher, right? But that doesn't mean that in the future they could be. So that's a policy in terms of saying, you know, if you're like a senior citizen that is in a fixed income, and we know that inflation is like happening across the board, but mostly in housing. So if you have been living in your home, most of the policies in other cities might be like 10 years or something like that. Then you are able to just like freeze the taxes to that particular period. So that's like a policy. Another thing that's happening in the West Side is, Michael talked about also like some of the demolition, right? So I think that having like taxes for demolition that are actually high, because the problem is that, you know, if you charge like $250,000 for demolishing a house and people end up being evicted, that's not enough. And that doesn't create like you know, what happens with that money? So it's like thinking about maybe putting it in a fund, so like more houses and builds, and also in the West Side. So kind of like thinking geographically how people could stay there if they're like being evicted because of a demolition of a high rise or a multi-story building. And of course, like, I think that one of the things mostly is like education and thinking about NIMBYism and thinking about like how people can also support affordable housing. So something that I think it happens in communities that are also relatively affordable, that people feel that their home prices will still go down if there's affordable housing there. So I think that education is absolutely key, as well as just talking to your neighbors about it and having conversations.
Dan, I just want to jump in there and say, I think it's really important we have a mindset that we don't make housing more affordable by making it more expensive. And so there is a policy balance between how we solve more, right? The market is short, we need more. The land values dictate where that's going to be more affordable to develop. That's leading to this gentrification pressure. It's why the preservation effort is so important in many regards. But broader than that, we won't have enough resources in the preservation effort to accommodate all the gentrification pressures. And so being mindful of the balance between how do we facilitate development while balancing this policy dynamic with gentrification and pricing out the community nearby is a very thoughtful one that needs probably a lot more exploration. But other markets have been down this road before us. You know, a question in the chat coming through, sorry to jump into your moderator one, is like, where's our market relative to others? And I've been listening to a book about California's housing struggles, and some of it feels, it's 40 years old, some of the stuff they're talking about, and it feels like the discussion we're having in our state now. So I think we're coming to an acute moment around our housing prices and housing struggles, and it's forcing conversations our states never had to have, like gentrification, and it's a healthy thing to have. It's just striking the right balance where we actually have good growth, we continue to eat away at the shortage that we have, while also making sure those that are living in these neighborhoods, A, are comfortable with the development, but also they benefit from the development. As your research recently showed, you know, higher density apartment buildings, those proximate to it actually had their property values go up relative to those who didn't. And so Ivis's point on education, helping people understand actually what's happening in the market, generally speaking, I think is really important.
Thank you, Michael. But I'll leave this question on advice to new homebuyers later, but I wanted to ask Beth, who are we leaving behind? You know, you're dealing with the most vulnerable population, but there's always people slipping through the crack, and what can we do to prevent that?
Thanks for the question. There's a few people that really come to my mind, and already I had previously alluded to people who are in our communities but don't have a legal status. They are still our neighbors. They are still attending our schools. They are part of our community. And we are definitely needing to be very mindful of, you know, their enrichment of our communities here. In addition to that particular demographic, I would say we need to be very mindful too of returning citizens, or depending on what circle you're a part of, that would be offenders. There's different philosophies and values around that, but one of their primary troubles post their time in corrections is finding housing and a job, right, at the same time. And beyond that, I would say that we're also in this conversation missing a component about domestic violence survivors. So what options are available to them? I'm not talking necessarily about the shelters that are available within our communities, but, you know, long-term strategies and what, again, is affordable to them and what options are available during this pandemic. There aren't very many per all of these reasons that we talked about in our conversation today. So it makes me think about some of our referrals. It makes me think about are referring folks to housing authorities, and what does that inventory look like? A number of homeowners don't necessarily feel the urgency to put their house in such an inventory, right? They want to get the most rent rather than being able to rent it out to somebody, you know, who might get a voucher or otherwise. We're needing to think about the landlord-tenant resolution as well. So there's a component within that and people that are kind of in those stuck points. And then we're needing to think about people who are wanting and needing housing down payment loans and grants to be able to dip their toe, not in the rental pool, but in the housing market to be a permanent fixture within their communities. That's what I would say to that answer or that question.
Thank you. Great. And thanks for setting up this next question with that last comment. And this is from we've heard a lot of conversation about the ability of different generations to purchase a home. With many audience members being students, millennial, and Gen Z, what advice would you give to these future home buyers? Is it even possible for them to own a home anytime soon? I'm dealing with this right now personally. I'm on the upper end of the millennium spectrum, but it is really hard to find a home right now. Who has thoughts on that? Maybe Michael, you guys have a really good first-time homebuyer program. Tell us some of those opportunities, and then others chime in as well, what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I would just, you know, for the average first-time homebuyer, college student looking to come out, number one is you're going to need to figure out how to get 3-5% down at a minimum. There are pretty advantageous financing programs from FHA and others that help get you down to that low down. So number one, don't think it has to be 20%. Sometimes that number becomes the barrier itself in people's minds that they can't afford home ownership because they can't save 20% of $400,000, $80,000. Like, no, you don't have to come up with that much money. A lot of those programs are dependent on credit though. And so being thoughtful what you're doing as a student now to build good credit. And if you've put yourself in a position where you've had some trouble, there are tons of credit rehab and help services that I would start focusing on now. Because the better your credit is, the better your interest rate is. It'll help you on private mortgage insurance, which is a huge cost for a lot of first-time homebuyers with those low down programs. And so you can do yourself a lot of good with those two things. Start saving. Don't think you have to save for the whole thing, and get your credit in a good spot. We have helped about 400 individuals and families since 2019 with our Utah Workforce Housing Priority Program, which is our most affordable homes. We won't sell to an investor. We only save those for teachers and firefighters and cops. And so we're pretty proud that just in 18, coming up on two, it's going to be about 2 years now, we're approaching our 400th sale in that program, which is a remarkable impact from the company side of things. The last thing I would just point you to is a really cool announcement in Ogden we made a few weeks ago with one of our winners at the Ivory Prize for Housing Affordability. This is out of our foundation arm. It's actually housed at the University of Utah. We're searching for the best ideas in the country to bring them home, but also to democratize them across the country. This program is called Landed. I won't take up too much of our remaining time on this, but just to tell you, they can come in alongside you with your down payment. They'll make a down payment with you, essentially, get you into the home, and then you refinance them out in a few years. But that has great, great potential as a market solution. Instead of always looking to the feds or the state or local to solve this problem, there are market solutions, and that's one of them. Landed's one of them. For those that are looking in the Ogden-Weber world, if you're a school teacher in Ogden School District, you're eligible for that program. And so I point you to that. But it is tough right now. I think the market is going to balance out a little bit in terms of the rapid appreciation we've seen in the later part of this year as we see the vaccines take hold. I'm hopeful the existing market starts to pick up a little bit. That will bring some supply on. And, you know, if we get some relief from these cost pressures on materials, labor, and everything else, that's going to help moderate things as well. But hopefully supply catches up a little bit at the tail end of this year. And the frenzy, I would call it a frenzy in the market right now for some, where we're seeing, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars over asking price, cash only offers. That's hard to compete with, as Dayan knows, as a first-time home buyer. It's hard to get in during that. So I'm hopeful by the tail end of this year, we see a calming in some of that behavior as supply catches up a little bit.
Right. I will give, thank you, Michael. I will give some bad financial advice to the students on here. I bought my first condo with the remainders of my student loan balance for the semester. That was my 3%. So, you know, be wise with how you spend that excess student loan money. Others, Jim, you had unmuted your mic when I asked that question about, you know, advice to future home buyers. And do you have any thoughts on that, or talking about the housing market outlook in general as well, to add to anything, or others as well?
Well, for future home buyers the student audience, I know this is it's hard to say, be patient in a market that is just exploding in prices, but probably going to have to rent for a while, and follow Michael's very good advice on building your credit. And also two incomes really helps. So that's important. And of course, education and jobs. But it is an unusual time. I don't know how this is gonna play out. I wrote my first article on housing market in 1974 about a new concept in Utah called condominiums. So I've seen a lot of, I've seen several cycles. I've never seen anything like this. We've never had a market like the last 6 months. I just ran the numbers this morning, Dayan, on the Wasatch Front, the four counties. First 2 months of the year, January and February, prices were up 17% for single family, 12% for condos, and most troublesome of all is the days on market went from 36 days in 2020 to 6 days in 2021. So this won't go on. Something will, the Fed right now, they're meeting tomorrow, and it looks like probably 2023, they're not going to be specific tomorrow, but rates will sneak up a bit. In the meantime, build credit, build your savings, and your income. I think that's pretty good advice.
Thank you, Jim. We have only a few minutes left. This was a little bit of a somber and depressing topic. Let's leave it on a positive note. What's something in housing that gives you hope, that gives you, you know, excitement that we're doing the right thing? Let's just go around. Evis, give us a positive outlook.
Well, this is going to be very general, but I think that when there's like moments of crisis, we tend to be inventive, right? And look into innovation and look into what other places are doing. So like any other crisis, it could be also an opportunity.
Good, thank you. Beth, how about from your end of the world?
I have to believe that the greatest minds are collaborating together, and that the spirit of Utahns, where we love kind of competition and trying to be the shining star of our United States, will come up with some really great solutions that other places will model after. I have to believe that. And in the interim, you know, I just have to say I'm so inspired by the team that I'm surrounded by, and the funders and people who keep us going to connect people to the resources they need, so they can keep on doing what it is that they want without asking where are they gonna sleep that evening.
Great, thank you. And then let's go to Michael, and then Jim will bring us to the curtain.
I think a positive note is you can be part of the solution if you're listening, and especially if you're a student. Don't think that you showing up to a city council meeting, you don't live in that city, and you speaking in favor of a project or a development, or just in general saying, please make a space for me, is wrong. I think that's a big thing that needs to shift, is that you, the future homeowners, the future renters, need to be part of the solution and encouraging our community to do exactly what Beth said, which is, at the top of the spectrum, there's a lot of political support and people get that this is a problem, we're working on it, but we've got to work our way into your friends and neighbors, your parents' neighbors, and city councils across the state to make sure that there's broad acknowledgement of it. But again, not in a spiteful way that somebody's done something wrong, but in the spirit of collaboration that we all want to be able to afford to call Utah home for a long time.
Bring us home, Jim.
Well, our housing prices and the acceleration really is due to our success as a state in economic growth and also demographic growth. But the increase in prices has brought in the legislature, which is really important. And the state is playing a larger role in the housing market. The feds are too. I think that's really positive. And the Biden administration looks like it's going to do some really interesting things for housing. So those are very positive. And prices going up like they have will induce innovation. And Michael knows about this and the Ivory innovation efforts. There will be innovations that will hold down the cost, and technology to hold down the cost of housing. That's going to be, I think, a really positive outcome over the next few years. We'll see some really interesting and cost-saving innovations in construction. And that's where we do have some leverage, and we have an opportunity to intervene. So, have hope. You'll get there, Dan.
That's our show. If you'd like to hear another Hinckley Forum, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Winoans Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.